The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Jason Solomons, and welcome back to Film Weekly. This week, we meet up with Ben Affleck to discuss his latest film, Gone Baby Gone.
Going into it, I thought there's a lot of ways I could fail at this. So I prepared as hard as I possibly could, and I worked as hard as I possibly could.
Yes, Affleck may be one of Hollywood's leading men, but this time he's firmly behind the camera as director and co-writer. That's coming up later. I'll be summing up Cannes 2008 and reviewing this year's Palme d'Or winner, Entre les Murs. I'll be talking to broadcaster and French critic Agnès Poirier. But first, Peter Biskind is that rare thing, a journalist and observer of the film industry who is actually liked and respected by actors and directors. He's the author of several books documenting Hollywood, including the legendary Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, and his book Down and Dirty Pictures, Miramax, Sundance and the Rise of Independent Film is regarded as one of the best written and most compelling histories of American independent cinema. As Miramax are about to reissue their back catalogue on DVD, I caught up with Peter to get a sense of its legacy and the state of American indies today. Welcome to Film Weekly, Peter Biskind. Thank you so much for joining us today. You're in New York, I hear.
Yes, I am.
Good. And that's the kind of place, I suppose, where Miramax launched themselves, aren't they? They were always seen to me, anyway, a more indie sensibility came out of New York than it did out of Los Angeles.
That's absolutely right. Yes, it's very definitely a New York phenomenon. Although, of course, there were a lot of indies in L.A., but it started in New York.
Is there something particularly New Yorkish about the indie movement? I always think of Jim Jarmusch, that sort of thing, as a more of a New York filmmaker than particularly of that kind of West Coast vibe.
Well, a lot of independence, you know, independent film scene or independent film world is extremely diverse phenomenon, and there are very few common denominators among them. But I guess you'd have to say that one of the common denominators that does exist is an anti-Hollywood aesthetic, you know, so that they would define themselves as everything that Hollywood isn't or everything that Los Angeles isn't. So in that sense, I think they were very much of a New York phenomenon. You know, they would be anti-plot. They would be script-driven as opposed to action-driven, character-driven, often unhappy endings, and they would be created by filmmakers who controlled every aspect of the process. Whereas with a Hollywood film, you get a director for hire, you get an editor for hire, you get a scriptwriter for hire. It's a much different thing.
It's always struck me as rather strange because Miramax managed to sort of be both of those things, because it was run by a sort of an old-fashioned mogul in Harvey Weinstein and his brother Bob. They were kind of producer directors in a way. They managed to kind of create a stamp of their own sort of blend. What for you typified a Miramax movie?
Well, I mean, you're right to the extent that I think Miramax evolved in that direction. Of course, when they first started out, they were merely distributing, although both of them had aspirations to be filmmakers, and they did make they wrote a couple of scripts, and they did try to make a movie called Playing for Keys, which was a bit of a disaster. I've never actually had the pleasure of seeing
it. No, neither have I.
I think they keep it under wraps, or perhaps they've destroyed every print. I don't know.
Do you know what? There's probably too many filmmakers want to get hold of it and kind of edit it and distribute it and then yes. Bury it as well.
Yes. Well, yes, and give them a little bit of their own taste of their own medicine. But absolutely, they, you know, it's hard to, again, characterize a Miramax film because they played both extremes of the spectrum. In other words, they would pick up very transgressive, gritty movies like, or movies full of sex and violence, or movies that nobody else wanted because they were too transgressive, like Peter Greenaway's The Cook, The Thief, or Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs, or Pulp Fiction, which was put in turnaround. I mean, they thrived on films that were put in quote unquote in turnaround by the studios. The studios would develop them for a bit and then decide they were too weird, which they decided about Pulp Fiction. On the other hand, they had a very sentimental streak, so they would pick up films like Cinema Paradiso or Il Postino or Mediterraneo, you know, films that were extremely sentimental. I guess the worst example of that, or best example, depending on your point of view, is Life is Beautiful. So they played both sides of the street, and they did that very successfully and very shrewdly.
That's right. You mentioned the foreign language titles that they espoused there as well, and Life is Beautiful, of course, which Benigni won Best Actor for at Cannes and then went on to the Oscars with, and polarizes people today. You know, I did a Holocaust lecture, the Holocaust on Film lecture at the ICA not long ago, and half the audience hate Life is Beautiful, but there was half of the audience in a very intellectual crowd in London that still love it.
Well, it's, what can I say? It's not my particular favorite movie, but, you know, a lot of people liked it, as you say.
They made a lot of money out of it, too.
Yes, they certainly did.
They espoused these foreign language films. I mean, the other flip side of that was The City of God, the Sequestro Express, is the kind of, you know, the kind of gritty foreigners. Look at them with their guns and their drugs. And there are also some espousal of British talent as well, particularly with the late Anthony Minghella, which they seem to have kind of made a specialty out of.
Well, yes. I mean, he was one of the, you know, so there was a small group of kind of house, you know, family, Miramax family, you know, house directors, you know, among them Quentin Tarantino, Anthony Minghella, Kevin Smith, John Madden, you know, there were a number of them. And and also under the rubric of gritty and British and gritty was, of course, Trainspotting, which they made quite a success of.
It's amazing that they kind of went from, as you say, distributing small indie titles, scraps, picking on scraps of the studio, to this kind of huge Oscar vehicle where they would regularly, every year, I think it was 20 years in a row, they got Best Picture nominations or a number of them. Films like, even with films that, you know, would definitely be called middle brow or kind of The Shipping News and Cold Cider House Rules and Chocolat and Captain Corelli and all these films that I would say now, you know, seem to have a kind of, I don't know, a veneer of a certain era, certainly about them. They're prestige titles, but they didn't seem to mean too much these days.
Well, it's not really surprising that those kinds of movies would be nominated. I mean, the Oscars are not exactly you know, the Booker Prize, so you know, that's more characteristic of, I think, the kinds of films that win Oscars than not. Now, of course, Miramax turned getting Oscar nominations and winning Oscars into a science by applying studio methods to that whole game. And they were, again, extremely successful at it, and it helped their movies. I mean, every time they would get a nomination, every time they would get an Oscar win, it would be more money at the box office and more prestige, and it helped them sign up acquire movies. You know, they could always say, "We'll get you an Oscar," you know, and often it was true.
And they generally did. I mean, the number of award ceremonies I went to where Gwyneth would get up or Nicole would get up, and, you know, in the speech, they would thank their mom, they would thank their dad, and then they would thank Harvey.
Well, Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, for My Left Foot, going all the way back to 1989. Nobody thought, you know, in those days, none of those films, Pele the Conqueror, none of those kinds of, you know, rather obscure foreign movies had a prayer at the Oscars. And suddenly it was only those movies that had a prayer.
So as with every great era, the all good things must come to an end, Peter. And sort of Miramax has, in a way, changed the face of the independent sector in the U.S. to the fact that it doesn't really exist anymore, it seems to me.
Well, that was partly the result of the success of Pulp Fiction. You know, I mean, and all these things go in cycles. And it's often true in Hollywood, as it is in life, that you can, you know, be destroyed by your own success.
You read the Bible, Greg.
Yes!
Well, there's this passage I got memorized. Sort of fits this occasion. Ezekiel 25:17. The path of the righteous man is beset on all sides by the inequities of the selfish and the tyranny of evil men. Blessed is he who in the name of charity and goodwill shepherds the weak through the valley of darkness, for he is truly his brother's keeper and the finder of lost children. And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to poison and destroy my brothers. And you will know my name is the Lord when I lay my vengeance upon thee.
You know, Pulp Fiction was the first movie to break the $100 million barrier, the first independent film, and it convinced all the studios that this was a business that they should be in, and then they started their independent divisions, and inevitably, there was sort of creeping studioization of this whole movement, so that You know, I think the Indiewood film, the phenomenon, had a lot to had a lot going for it, but at the same time, indie films became to came to look more and more like Hollywood films with big stars, big budgets, very slick, and I think inevitably that eats away at the heart of the independent film.
You've been chronicling Sundance as well as a kind of they coexisted, Miramax and Sundance and the rise of indie film. Sundance is a slightly different place these days, and I remember when your book came out and made a bit of a fuss. I think it came out on the eve of one Sundance Festival a couple of years ago. Obviously, kind of sent shockwaves around that, or maybe avalanches, probably more an apt metaphor, around that snowy hillside. Where's Sundance going now, and will we see a rebirth of that? Will we see that kind of underground movement resurface somewhere else?
Well, to answer the second question first, I think you will, partly because, as I said a second ago, it's a cyclical business. And when things get too corporatized and too studioized and too Hollywoodized, there's always people coming up from the bottom, especially now with a new technology, which makes it much easier and much less expensive to make movies. I definitely think you're going to find a new groundswell coming up from the bottom. As far as Sundance goes, I think, again, speaking of being destroyed by success, I think the biggest threat to Sundance now is it's so successful, it's so, every inch, every snowflake is sponsored practically, so that it's become very corporatized. It's become, in many ways, the thing that Redford was afraid of when he initially opposed the Sundance taking over the U.S. Film Festival in 1985.
Where can we see examples of the underground bubbling up again? Where do you think the indie spirit will be reborn?
At this point, you really have to go tilling the soil to find them.
It's true, because, I mean, you think Clooney carries that Redford spirit of the next generation, but his films are pretty big, They're at the Oscars, He makes Good Night and Good Luck, and it's Oscar-nominated.
Well, I mean, you have the generation of the 90s still making movies and many good movies. I mean, Soderbergh is still working. David O. Russell is working on a new movie. P.T. Anderson. They're all still going strong. And then you have, probably not one younger generation, but two younger generations. But as I just indicated, I'd be hard-pressed to think of any names.
It feels like Funny Ha Ha and the mumblecore generation. Do you see that kind of getting anywhere, or can you not understand what the word they're saying?
Well, I thought that was a joke when I first read it, when I first read that term. But, of course, a lot of things that you think are jokes actually become quite serious. I mean, I've seen some of those movies. They're definitely interesting. They're definitely interesting directors. The kinds of movies that get distributed now, I mean, it's a bit of a hard time for independents now. I mean, Warner Brothers just closed down Warner Independent and Picture House.
That's right, and New Line closed.
And New Line closed, more or less, or got, emasculated, I suppose the phrase would be, because a lot of these movies are just not making money, and these divisions are not making as much money as they used to. Now, the reasons for that are many and various, but it doesn't bode well, of course, for the future. On the other hand, maybe these divisions have served their purpose. It's really hard to say at this point. I think we're in the middle of a transition right now, and I think it's not clear exactly how it's going to turn out.
Peter Biskin, thank you very much for joining us on Film Weekly.
Well, thank you very much, Jason.
My thanks to Peter Biskin there. And as we mentioned earlier, Miramax are due to release their entire back catalogue on DVD. So for two lucky Film Weekly listeners, we've got a selection of titles to give away, including Pulp Fiction by Quentin Tarantino and Kevin Smith's Clocks. We have two DVD packs, as I said, to give away. All you've got to do to win one is tell us how many Kevin Smith films has Ben Affleck appeared in. Email us at film.weekly@observer.co.uk. That's film.weekly@observer.co.uk. And of course, I'll be talking to Mr. Ben Affleck later on in the programme. But first, if you like Film Weekly, why not listen to this?
Hello, I'm Paul McInnes. And on this week's Music Weekly from Guardian.co.uk, we'll be talking to the Mystery Jets. The up-and-coming band will be telling us about the finer arts of production and being called Dad Ditchers. Whatever that is, you have to tune in to find out. We'll also be speaking to Andy Burrows, drummer of Razorlight and now solo artist, on who really wrote their mega hit America. And Dorian Lynskey will be joining us to review new music. from Does It Offend You? Yeah, Lil Wayne and Stephen Malkmus. Register and get all this sent to your computer or MP3 player for free. Go to guardian.co.uk/music.
Last week on our Cannes special, we were taking an educated guess that the Italian film Gomorra would take the top prize of the Palme d'Or. Well, we were pretty close as Matteo Garrone's film took the second prize, the Grand Prix du Jury, because the Palme d'Or was in fact scooped at the last minute by the French film Entre les Murs, or The Class as it's being called around the world, directed by Laurent Conté. And joining me now to discuss the film and France's first winner since 1987 of its home festival is writer and critic Agnès Poirier. Welcome to Film Weekly, Agnès.
Bonjour.
Bonjour. You must be very proud of a French winner at last.
Yes, well, proud. You know, we're always proud when a good film gets the Palme d'Or, wherever it comes from. And but as you said, we didn't know. It was such a surprise because rumors started spreading as always at the on Sunday morning, and it wasn't on the list. And we thought, oh my God, because the film was showed so late in the festival. I mean, basically the last day, and all my film critics friends loved it. And of all different nationalities. And so when it came, you know, when suddenly Sean Penn said Entre les Murs, I didn't understand at first because his French is so dreadful. But and then I saw Laurent Conté, you know, stands up. And it was wonderful. I thought Bashir was going to get it. And actually it's the only film that is really missing from his very good award list.
That's right, the Israeli film Waltz with Bashir, which went home totally empty-handed, much to our surprise here on Film Week as well. We thought at least some kind of special award for the unique animated look of it. And yes, how has France reacted to the first winner in since Sous le Soleil de Satan, which won in 1987 and was booed at Cannes when it was announced that won. So incensed with the French that such a terrible film should win the Palme d'Or. So this one, I assume, has gone down rather better.
Well, it has, yeah, for the people who saw it, but perhaps also it because they were so surprised that he was going to get it. It is a very honest film, and it shows, you know, France today as it is and without any bias. And of course, then I'm sure it will trigger a debate because it's all about education and how you teach children, and actually what it shows us to see is quite bewildering. You suddenly realize, oh my God, is it really what's going on within the walls, entre les murs, of a classroom in actually what is not, the worst school. It's just another average school in the 20th district of Paris. It's not a very privileged part of Paris. There are a lot of people from different origins, but still, I mean, the school is not in terrible difficulty compared to other schools in suburbs of Paris.
People are saying it's an inner city school, aren't they, in their report, which I think is a bit wrong because I, in fact, taught at a school about a mile away from that school. I taught at the Lycée Paul Valéry, which is in the 12th, just below the 20th, and it's exactly the same as that school. It was a few years ago now, and my class never quite got to the difficulties that teacher's class got to. But those tensions were always seething because we have a Benetton advert of a class here, don't we? We have a Chinese kid, we have African kids, we have Arabic kids, we have French kids, we have Gothic kids, we have hip-hop kids, we have the whole nation there. And I thought it was a wonderful mix of society, really reflected, and it showed how difficult it is to teach that society within the system's design, because that's what Conté's films are always about, the mechanics of a system, aren't they, Agnès?
No, it is, absolutely. But of course, it has already triggered a debate, you know, between the people who favour much stricter approach to education. I mean, and you understand it very well, because sometimes, you know, you see these kids or even the teachers and you just want to, you know, bring back the guillotine, and you think this is not acceptable. They shouldn't, you know, talk like this.
They're
to
so
their
rude.
Teacher, or the teachers shouldn't be so complacent. On the other hand, you see this incredibly intelligent pupil, sometimes and extremely witty, and they make you laugh and they are very tender, and of course they also turn very vicious, and the teacher himself sometimes is quite lax, and you think, you know, can't you be just, more tougher with his kids. On the other hand, he tries his best, and sometimes he manages to engage with the pupils when a much more, a much stricter education approach would actually fail. So really the success and the incredible achievement of Laurent Cantet is to show things as they are and in a totally neutral way. And he manages through, little anecdotes to depict this very colorful picture of France now. And we haven't got that, even with Lion. Lion was very different. I mean, this one is Être et Avoir meets Lion.
Yes, a very good pitch there. I think you should you do very well selling this film abroad. But I gather it was one of the most hotly bought titles in the marché, in the market in Canada. It has been bought for England by Artificial Eye, so we will be seeing it here in the UK. And of course, it has been bought for the United States as well. I can see this film going all the way to the Oscars, and yes, because of its kind of interesting way of filming, not just its subject, but it's also, you wonder how he's done that with these young actors who have never acted before. In fact, the teacher himself, François Bégaudeau, he's not a professional actor. In fact, he was the writer of the book upon which this was based. How has he got such wonderful performances, Laurent Cantet? Tell us a bit about him and his films before, Emploi du Temps and Ressources Humaines, and his methods of working.
Well, his trademark is work, work, work. I mean, and that's why he makes a film every 3 years. It's because he researches it, he documents it, a bit like an investigative journalist, and he really immerses himself in the subject. With resources, human resources, he really went for a year living the life of an employee. And it's the same here. I mean, for a whole year, he went to that school and he did some workshop with the kids of the school who wanted to be part of this sort of theater workshop. And of course, at the beginning, he had 50 of them. And as time went by, he only had about 15 or 20 of them. And after a year long of rehearsals, he started filming during the summer. And François Bégaudeau also is an ex-teacher of French, and he wrote this novel about his experience. So although it's fiction, none of them are professional actors. It's an ex-teacher playing the part of a teacher, and students, real students, playing almost their parts. And although there is a script, and it's extremely well written and very well researched and documented. It's not improvised at all. But all the situations actually ring so true and so sincere. Apart, perhaps, but we're not going to give it away, the last scene when one of the pupils, talks about a certain book that she's read, and if only it was true, but you have the feeling that perhaps Laurent Cantet is giving this to us so that we leave, happier. But even then, I mean, it works. I mean, it's a tiny detail. I mean, tiny criticism.
The teacher looks pretty shocked that she's reading this text, which we will leave. It's a very intellectual shock. It's a very sort of shock that the audience in Cannes were shocked at. I doubt whether the audience in, Bognor Regis on a wet Wednesday afternoon will be too shocked when she comes forth with this.
Well, it's a wonderful
text.
Idea, if only it was true, because that particular pupil, proved so lazy and so vicious and so stupid, but also quite endearing. But I doubt she actually read that book. But it doesn't matter. I mean, in a way, this encapsulates the whole idea of that film, and everything else is quite bewildering in the way that it is real.
Yes, and it was also very funny as well, as you mentioned, that the humour was extraordinary. I mean, I laughed till I cried, actually, partly with recognition of having taught in a French class not far from that class itself, but also the very real reactions and the realness of the script. I thought, in a can of not much laughter, it provided almost kind of weeping joy for me, actually. A great relief I had at this film that I actually felt some love for rather than respect for, so I'm delighted it won. And yes, it's no secret that you're very well in on the Cannes scene, and you advise Cannes on the state of British film industry, which is something we always like to examine here. But in the end, Cannes actually, maybe thanks partly to you, had not a bad showing from the Brits as well. The Camarador for Steve McQueen's Hunger. So how was British cinema received out there this year?
I think it was extremely well received. I mean, yes, as you mentioned, the Caméra d'Or, which usually goes to a Critics Week film, went to Steve McQueen and Hunger, which, I mean, if you remember, was opened the Un Certain Regard section, and actually, you know, it was the first shock of the festival. A lot of people talked about it. The reviews were raving about the film. It was also this beautiful, we must remind people that you get the best projections, you know, the best screenings in Cannes, and, you know, that CinemaScope 35mm print was superb. But also there was this second film by Thomas Clayson, Cowboy, which was well reviewed, and Better Things in Critics Week by Adrian Hopkins, and of course Terence Davis, Ode to Liverpool of Time and the City.
Yeah, well, thank you for that, because I know that Terence, when I spoke to him, he was very thankful for you for putting him sort of, you suggested him and said, look at Terence Davis's film, and you've kind of resurrected one of the great auteurs, or the only auteurs of current British cinema. So merci beaucoup to you, Agnès Poirier, and for joining us today on Film Weekly.
Thank you, merci.
And finally, on Film Weekly, Ben Affleck is already a hugely successful actor, a member, indeed, of Hollywood's golden circle of leading men, having already played superheroes such as Daredevil and super agents such as Jack Ryan in The Sum of All Fears. He's also won an Oscar for his co-writing on the film Good Will Hunting with his great mate Matt Damon. But now Affleck has decided to take the director's chair with a new film, Gone Baby Gone. The film stars his brother, Casey Affleck, alongside Morgan Freeman and Ed Harris. I met up with Ben earlier and started out by asking him why this was the film that made him want to make his directing debut.
Well, the book appealed to me for a number of reasons. I mean, one, that I really liked the story. I thought it was complicated and mostly, I guess, kind of morally ambiguous, and it wasn't, didn't spend a lot of time judging the characters, and kind of the opposite of that. It left all those judgments open to the audience, you know.
Was it something to do with the Boston setting as well? Because, I mean, obviously, you know, it takes us back to Good Will Hunting and your kind of affection for that area.
Yeah, I thought as a director that gave me definitely something comfortable that I really understood. You know, I grew up there, so I knew where the people came from, kind of how they behaved, what their houses might look like, what they might keep in them, what kind of clothes they might wear. So that's the kind of thing that you'd have to do months of research to figure out that I got to bring to it right away. And so that was a safety net for me.
And you show off your accent as well.
Right. I knew the accent too. So I knew when it was authentic and when it wasn't.
What is it? It's a kind of soft, it's like apartment.
Yeah, it's kind of like apartment. Yeah, that's right.
You like to get it in there, do you? Because you and Matt both like to kind of do Boston, because you did the Departed.
Yes, that's right, the Departed, yeah. That's any R, it goes out the window with the Boston accent. It's definitely, if you have an excuse to do it, it's a fun accent to do. It's definitely very dramatic. I think that's why, you know, people don't do, like, Ohio accents, for example, aren't quite as, they're much more subtle. They're probably harder to do, but you don't see them in movies as much.
Is it, it's not an area of the US that I know, but the sort of working class area that you depict, is it easier to go in somewhere like that and kind of pick out all the faces that you pick and the kind of dingy bars and without kind of feeling that you're sort of some kind of tragedy tourist or at least some kind of, you know, middle class person picking out the kind of detritus of society?
Yeah, I think I never felt that way. I think the thing about the movie that I wanted to do was, you know, much more often you see these kind of Chamber of Commerce shots or the tourist shots and that sort of thing you see about cities when you go there. And what I wanted to do was reflect the city as I knew it and to show it without judgment one way or the other, without showing a sort of glamorized, sexier version or without showing a more specifically aimed at, like, this is going to be a grungier version, but simply a humanist, unjudged, you know, this is the people, this is who they are, carrying on with their lives, sometimes broken, sometimes happy, simply, you know, being who they are. That was my goal.
I mean, because you enter into a kind of quite a moral kind of river, I suppose Mystic River is the same author, and there's the kind of undercurrents here that are the same in here. There's kind of moral mazes that you enter. You don't know who's a good guy, who's a bad guy in the end, and even when the kind of ostensible mystery is solved, you're still left kind of pondering as to who was morally right.
Obviously, Mystic River was a big influence. You know, the great Clint Eastwood made that movie, and it's one I tremendously admire. And Lehane wrote the book. And so those, that, as you say, that kind of undercurrent, to stay with the metaphor of, you know, of darkness and moral ambiguity and, I guess, mystery, is definitely present in this movie as well, or I hoped it would be, because I think... I think for one thing, it's dramatic, and I mean, it makes it interesting, and it also it speaks to some of the themes in this movie, which again has to do with, you know, Casey's character sort of becomes a man, and a part of that to me meant going from a certain kind of certainty to understanding that you can never really be sure about anything.
A priest says shame is God telling you what you did was wrong. Murder's a sin.
Depends on who you do it to.
It's not how it works. It is what it is.
It's a war, man. Are we winning? No.
He goes from being righteous to being to accepting a level of humility.
He's your younger brother, Casey Affleck. I mean, was it? Have you directed? I know you worked with him. He was in Good Will Hunting, of course. But have you worked with him before? What's he like? Do you have to slap him about a bit? Do you have to mess his room up?
I tried to reprise the working relationship we had on 200 cigarettes, and failing that, no, I think we, you know, I think as a director, though I, you know, speak in that capacity, having only directed one movie, you're really lucky if you feel like you've cast the right actor for the part, mm-hmm. you know, and you get an actor who does a really good job. So in that sense, I lucked out, and I was happy with that, and anything past that, I didn't worry about too much, you know. He was my brother, but to be honest with you, I didn't even deal with him too much outside of just as an actor. I had too much to worry about. I was right up to my capacity, you know, skill level, and I didn't have much room for socializing or anything else. So he knew what he was doing. I could talk to him about that, and you know, his fraternizing and hanging around. I was too busy, you know, doing what I needed to do to even be part of the fun and game.
How did you know what to do? I always wondered this with an actor. I mean, yeah, you've been in over 40 movies, but I mean, just being in Daredevil doesn't mean you're not going to know how to make a kind of nice social realist portrait of Boston.
No, it doesn't mean much, really. I spent a lot of time learning, you know, while I was an actor. I viewed being an actor as an opportunity to, you know, go to film school for free in a lot of ways. And I've worked with a lot of really exceptional directors. And I made sure that I paid attention to what they were doing and asked them a lot of questions. I had the luxury of standing next to them. Mm-hmm. I forgot a lot of it, but I remembered some. And
who was the one that really kind of hit home?
The first name that comes to mind is Roger Michel. He's a guy I think is brilliant.
Our own Roger Michel from Changing Lanes.
Yes, Changing Lanes, yes. And yes, your own Roger Michel, British Roger Michel. He's a brilliant guy, you know. He's just a wonderful guy. But, I mean, I learned something from your own Kevin MacDonald, in fact, who I just worked with. I had already directed my movie by then. But, you know, I almost have made it a habit now to learn from people. And, you know, from Gus Van Sant, somebody I learned a huge amount from. You know, you just it's served me really, really well. And you know, you don't know how to direct a movie from that. But when I came to places where I felt like I didn't know what to do, I definitely was able to fall back on, you know, stuff that people told me, and it gave me it got me kind of halfway there. And you know, the rest of it, you know, I'd sort of relied on preparation. I thought, there's a lot of ways going into it. I thought there's a lot of ways I could fail at this, but what I have control over are, you know, preparation and hard work. So I can make sure I don't fail for the lack of those two things. And so I prepared as hard as I possibly could, and I worked as hard as I possibly could, you know. And I had listened to a lot of really smart people, and those three things got me through.
My thanks to Ben Affleck there, and to all my guests on this week's Film Weekly. Remember, for more film news and reviews, go to www.guardian.co.uk/film. And of course, check out Trailer Trash in this Sunday's Observer. But for now, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.